Even while his father was still alive, he was fined a talent by him for putting up battlements around his own house. And after his father's death, being by nature harsh, which was in fact the very reason for his nickname, and moreover keeping company with a wicked friend, Larchus, he became a tyrant instead of a king. Larchus, plotting against the tyranny and driving out or murdering the best of the Cyrenians, turned the blame onto Arcesilaus. And finally, having thrown him into a wasting and severe illness by making him drink a sea hare, he destroyed him, while he himself took over the rule, professing to be guarding it for Arcesilaus's son Battus. The boy was held in contempt both because of his lameness and because of his youth, but many attached themselves to his mother, for she was prudent and kind, and had many powerful relatives. For this reason, Larchus, courting her favor, sought her in marriage, and asked that Battus be made his adopted son once he married her, and that he be declared partner in the rule. Eryxo, for that was the woman's name, after deliberating with her brothers, told Larchus to negotiate with them, as though she herself were willing to accept the marriage. But when Larchus approached the brothers, they deliberately put him off and kept postponing. So Eryxo sent a servant girl of her own to tell him that at present her brothers were objecting, but that once the meeting took place, they would cease their opposition and consent. Therefore he should, if he wished, come to her by night, for once the arrangement was made, everything else concerning the rule would go well. This was entirely to Larchus's liking, and, utterly enraptured by the woman's friendliness, he agreed to come whenever she should summon him. Eryxo was carrying out this plan together with Polyarchus, the eldest of her brothers. When the time for the meeting had been fixed, Polyarchus was secretly brought into his sister's chamber, having with him two young men armed with swords, bent on avenging their father's murder, whom Larchus had recently killed. When Eryxo sent for Larchus, he came in without his bodyguards, and when the young men fell upon him, he died, struck through with their swords. They threw the corpse over the wall, and, bringing Battus forward, proclaimed him king according to ancestral custom, and Polyarchus restored to the Cyrenians their original form of government. Now it happened that many soldiers of Amasis, king of Egypt, were present, whom Larchus had used as his trusted men, and it was chiefly through them that he had been feared by the citizens. These men sent envoys to Amasis to accuse Polyarchus and Eryxo. He was angered and was intending to make war on the Cyrenians when it happened that his mother died, and while he was conducting her funeral rites, messengers arrived from Amasis. Polyarchus therefore resolved to go and defend himself, and since Eryxo would not be left behind but wished to accompany him and share the danger, her mother Critola, though an old woman, was not left behind either. She was a woman of the highest standing, being the sister of Battus the Fortunate. When they arrived in Egypt, the rest of the court marveled greatly at their action, and Amasis himself was not moderate in his admiration for the woman's prudence and courage. Honoring them with gifts and royal hospitality, he sent Polyarchus and the women back to Cyrene. One might no less admire Xenocrit of Cumae for what she accomplished against Aristodemus the tyrant, whom some suppose to have gotten the nickname Malichus, the soft, for a false reason, not knowing the truth. In fact, he was called Malichus by the barbarians, a term meaning still a boy, because while still a mere youth, among his coevals who still wore their hair long, men whom, it seems, they called Corontists from their hair, he distinguished himself, brilliant in the wars against the barbarians, not only for daring and feats of the hand, but for showing exceptional intelligence and foresight. Hence he rose to the highest offices, admired by his fellow citizens, and was sent to bring aid to the Romans when they were being attacked by the Tyrrhenians, who were trying to restore Tarquinius Superbus to the throne. In the course of this long campaign, by yielding in every way to please the citizen soldiers under his command, courting popular favor rather than commanding as a general should, he persuaded them to join him against the Senate, and to help him expel the best and most powerful men. Having thus become tyrant, in his crimes against women and freeborn children, he outdid even himself in wickedness. It is recorded that he trained the male children to wear their hair long and to deck themselves in gold, while he compelled the girls to have their hair cropped round and to wear the short cloaks and sleeveless tunics of youths. Moreover, having fallen especially in love with Xenocrit, he kept her though her father was in exile, neither restoring him nor persuading him to return, but supposing in some fashion that the girl was content to live with him, since she was envied and counted blessed by the citizens for it. These things did not overawe her. Rather, resentful of living with him, unwed and unbetrothed, she longed no less than those the tyrant hated for the freedom of her homeland. Now it happened at that time that Aristodemus was having a trench dug all around the countryside, a task neither necessary nor useful, but meant simply to wear down and exhaust the citizens with labor and lack of leisure, since each man had been assigned a set quota of earth to bring out of the ground. And a certain woman, seeing Aristodemus approaching, turned aside and covered her face with her tunic. When Aristodemus had passed by, some young men, mocking and joking, asked her why it was that only from Aristodemus, out of shame, she turned away, while toward others she felt nothing of the kind. She answered, with great earnestness, "Because," she said, "Aristodemus alone of the Cumaeans is a man." This remark, once spoken, touched everyone and spurred the noble-minded out of shame to lay hold of freedom. It is said, too, that Xenocrate, on hearing it, said that she herself would rather carry earth on behalf of her father, were he present, than share in Aristodemus's luxury and so great a power. This strengthened the resolve of those conspiring against Aristodemus, whose leader was Thymodes, and since Xenocrate's access to him gave them a safe entry and left Aristodemus unarmed and unguarded, they slipped in without difficulty and killed him. Thus the city of the Cumaeans was liberated through the virtue of two women, the one having instilled in the conspirators the idea and impetus for the deed, the other having lent her help toward its completion. When great honors and gifts were offered to Xenocrate, she declined them all and asked for one thing only: to bury the body of Aristodemus. This, then, they granted her, and they also chose her as priestess of Demeter, believing that this honor would be no less pleasing to the goddess than it was fitting for her. It is said also that the wife of Pythes, who lived in the time of Xerxes, was a wise and good woman. Pythes himself, it seems, having come upon gold mines and grown fond of the wealth from them, not moderately but insatiably and to excess, spent his own time occupied with this, and, dragging all the citizens down to it equally, forced them to dig or carry or refine the gold, doing and working at nothing else whatsoever. As many perished and all cried out against it, the women came as suppliants and set up a supplication at the doors of Pythes's wife. She bade them go away and take heart, and she herself summoned the craftsmen most skilled in working gold, in whom she placed the greatest trust, and, shutting them up in private, ordered them to make loaves of gold, and cakes of every kind and fruits. Everything, in short, that she knew Pythes took the greatest pleasure in eating and enjoying. When everything had been made, Pythes returned from abroad, for he happened to be traveling, and when he asked his wife for dinner, she set before him a golden table holding nothing edible at all, but everything made of gold. At first Pythes was delighted with the imitations, but once he had had his fill of looking at them, he asked to eat. She, whatever he desired, brought it to him in gold. When he grew exasperated and cried out that he was hungry, she said, "But it is of these very things that you have provided us in abundance, and of nothing else. For all skill and all craft has vanished, no one farms any longer, but leaving behind what the earth sows, plants, and nourishes, we dig for useless things and search for them, wearing ourselves and the citizens out." This moved Pythes, and though he did not put an entire stop to the business of the mines, he ordered a fifth part of the citizens to work them in rotation, and turned the rest to farming and to their crafts. When Xerxes was marching down against Greece, Pythes, having been most magnificent in his receptions and gifts, asked a favor of the king. Since he had several sons, that one be allowed to remain behind from the campaign and be left to care for him in his old age. But Xerxes, in anger, slaughtered this one son alone, the very one he had asked for, cut him in two, and ordered the army to march between the pieces, while he took the rest of the sons with him, and all of them perished in the battles. At this Pythes, losing heart, suffered what happens to many foolish and unhappy men. He feared death, yet was weary of life. Wishing not to live, yet unable to let go of living, since there was a great mound in the city with a river flowing through it, which they called the Pythopolites, he built a monument within the mound and diverted the river's course so that it would flow through the mound, touching the tomb. Once this had been accomplished, he himself went down into the monument, and having handed over the rule and the entire city to his wife, ordered that no one approach him, but that his dinner be sent to him each day placed in a boat, until the boat should pass the tomb with the meal untouched, at which point they were to stop sending it, as a sign that he had died. He himself thus spent the rest of his life in this way, while his wife administered the rule well and brought about a change of fortunes for the people.